When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today I'm delighted to talk to Dr. Muhammad Hassan Khalil. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you so much, Paul, for inviting me. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you on. Muhammad Hassan Khalil is Professor of Religious Studies, Adjunct Professor of Law, and Director of the Muslim Studies Program at Michigan State University, obviously in the US. He specializes in Islamic thought and is the author of Islam and the Fate of Others, The Salvation Question, with Oxford University Press, and more recently, Jihad, Radicalism, and the New Atheism, published by Cambridge University Press. I have my lovely copy here, but coming to that in a minute. He's also the editor of, amongst other works, Between Heaven and Hell, Islam, Salvation, and the Fate of Others, also published by Oxford University Press. Now, today, Muhammad has kindly agreed to discuss Islam and the New Atheism, a really interesting subject. And Mohammed very kindly had this sent to me beforehand, this particular book, Jihad, Radicalism and the New Atheism. And, you know, I've read quite a few academic works over this. This is very readable and triggering. Boy, is it triggering. The contents page there, you can probably just see it. Part one, Jihad, War and the Foundational Texts of Islam and Jihad in Islamic Law. And then part two, Violent Radicalism, Bin Laden, 9/11 and ISIS. And then the third part, the New Atheism. We are at war with Islam. The case of Sam Harris, the famous American atheist. And it is about Islam, the case of Ayaan Hirsi Ali. And then another chapter on Dawkins, and who I noticed Richard Dawkins is still tweeting about Islam even now. I noticed a few days ago, he's still at it, so to speak. Christopher Hitchens is no longer with us, of course, and Daniel Dennett. So I found this a very readable, if very triggering book. It's very existential. You know, this is not dry academic work. So I do recommend it, is what I'm trying to say. If you can get hold of is this available in paperback?
Yes, it is. It is. Yes.
Great. So if you can get it in paperback, I do recommend it. Perhaps I'll put a link into it in the description below. But in the meantime, as I say, you kindly agreed to discuss Islam and the New Atheism, the way they weaponize this kind of extreme Islamophobic narrative about Islam. But I'll let Mohammed explain. So over to you, sir.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate that. And I wonder if we can pull up the slides here. Yeah, perfect. So, as you mentioned, my book is entitled Jihad, Radicalism, and the New Atheism. And this book examines the views, basically examines how three very different groups conceptualize armed jihad. So we're not talking about jihad in general. We're talking specifically about armed jihad. Mm. And the three groups are popular and influential Muslim clerics and scholars of Islam, violent radicals or extremists who claim to represent Islam, and the so-called new atheists who are critical of Islam. Mm. Now, in case you're wondering, this book was inspired by a viral moment from October 2014, when the new atheist neuroscientist Sam Harris appeared on Real Time with Bill Maher.
And that's him on the right, by the way. Just
that's right. That's right. Yep.
Yep, there's him on the right there, Sam Harris. Yep,
that's right. And in the middle, we have host Bill Maher, and on the left, actor Ben Affleck.
Yep.
And while debating actor Ben Affleck, Harris described Islam as the mother lode of bad ideas.
No doubt.
And I'd like to revisit this episode later in our conversation. Mm. For now, I'll simply say that the research for my book actually led me to appreciate the many ways that early Islamic tradition limits and regulates warfare. Mm. And so when contemporary Muslim extremists attempt to justify the killing of innocent civilians, they have no choice but to engage in interpretive acrobatics, unsuccessfully, I would add, in order to get around the fact that there are various widely accepted legal precepts and hadiths, prophetic reports, that explicitly prohibit the targeting of women, children, and various categories of non-combatant men. This book project also allowed me to appreciate just how problematic new atheist discussions of Islam have been. With this in mind, I'd like to present another scene from the fall of 2014. In the midst of a lively televised exchange between journalist Fareed Zakaria, or Zakaria as he pronounces it, and Sam Harris on the topic of jihad, Zakaria declared, "The problem is you and Osama bin Laden agree. After all, you're saying his interpretation of Islam is correct." "Well," Harris responded, "his interpretation, this is the problem. His interpretation of Islam is very straightforward and honest, and you really have to split hairs and do some interpretive acrobatics in order to get it to look non-canonical." These are Harris's words, and as I've already indicated, I found that the opposite was true.
Yep.
In any case, this exchange is a good representation of the logic of many
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Of the individuals commonly known as New Atheists. In the years following the 9/11 tragedy, these so-called New Atheists produced influential anti-theistic and anti-religious works, and much of their focus was on Islam. Some New Atheist writers were themselves profoundly transformed by 9/11. In the case of the prominent ex-Muslim writer Ayaan Hirsi Ali, for instance, she stopped believing in Islam when, as she puts it, she found it impossible to discount bin Laden's claims that the murderous destruction of innocent lives is consistent with the Quran. These are her words. As for Harris, he reportedly began writing his landmark book, The End of Faith, on September 12, 2001.
Wow.
In this New York Times bestseller, and the reason for much of his initial popularity, Harris writes that the feature of Islam most troubling to non-Muslims is the very principle bin Laden invoked to justify 9/11, jihad. And as the English evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins would have it, it was belief in the literal truth of the Quran that led 19 well-educated middle-class men to kill thousands of people on 9/11. Never mind the fact that after making this statement, Dawkins, Professor Dawkins, conceded on Twitter that he had not yet read the entire Quran. In this brief presentation, I intend to scrutinize the New Atheist claim that Islamic scripture is the best explanation for what is called Muslim terrorism. And of course, this claim is not unique to the New Atheists. So some might ask, why talk about the New Atheists? Isn't this giving them undue attention? Well, I chose to focus on the New Atheists largely because of their unique and ostensibly significant influence on Western and to some extent non-Western intellectual discourse. Having taught in the humanities at two public research universities in the American Midwest, I have found that many of my own colleagues and students were profoundly impacted by the writings of New Atheists. As such, I didn't think it made much sense to ignore them. Of course, I should also add here that new atheists represent only themselves and not atheists more generally. In fact, some of their most outspoken critics have been other atheists.
But that's an important point. That's an important point, by the way. Is that some of the most trained critics of people like Dawkins and their claims to represent science, particularly, have been shot down by. I mean, I think of Stephen Jay Gould, for example, the prominent American biologist, extremely critical. He was an atheist as well, very critical of Dawkins, and he is representative of many, many eminent scientists who believe that Dawkins is abusing science for his own atheist ideology. Even though they share that ideology, they don't like the way he does it. You think he's weaponizing science to illegitimate purposes. So I think it's a really important point you make there.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Now, in the brief time we have, I'd like to actually pay special to, although I'm tempted to talk about Dawkins at length.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. I'm actually going to be focusing on Sam Harris in this conversation. And this is someone who continues to have a large following. Now, though critical of all monotheistic traditions, Harris has much to say about what he once called the problem with Islam. And this is the title of one of the chapters of The End of Faith. Indeed, from the very beginning of this influential book, published in 2004, Harris casts a light on this particular problem. Harris opens The End of Faith in dramatic fashion, depicting a scene in which a suicide bomber detonates himself in a crowded bus. Harris tells us that the bomber's parents are sad when they hear the news, but also feel tremendous pride because they know that he has gone to heaven and has sent his victims to hell for eternity. It is a double victory. Assuming we know nothing else about the bomber, such as his past, economic status, etc., Harris rhetorically asks, why is it so easy, so trivially easy, you could almost bet your life on it easy, to guess the young man's religion? Harris's point here is that religious beliefs, in this case Islamic ones, can be dangerous. And I'll come back to this point. Inspired as he was by 9/11 to compose The End of Faith, Harris has much to say about Muslim suicide terrorism. As he presents it, it is Islamic ideology that best explains this phenomenon. After all, Harris notes, Muslim terrorists define themselves in religious terms. Of course, the same is true for many of their Muslim opponents, a significantly larger group. But for Harris, the exception often proves the rule. And so still in the introduction to The End of Faith, Harris attempts to present Islamic ideology as being inherently dangerous by describing a real-life historical example, an example of a so-called failed Palestinian suicide bomber named Zidane Zidane. Here's all that Harris tells us about Zidane. He described being pushed to attack Israelis by the love of martyrdom. He, Zidane, added, I didn't want revenge for anything. I just wanted to be a martyr. Mr. Zidane, the would-be martyr, conceded that his Jewish captors were better than many, many Arabs. With regard to the suffering that his death would have inflicted upon his family, he reminded his interviewer that a martyr gets to pick 70 people to join him in paradise. He would have been sure to invite his family along. Now again, this is all Harris tells us about Zidane. So the impression one gets is that his violent intentions were simply the outcome of Islamic doctrines of jihad and martyrdom and had nothing to do or little to do with politics or anything else. But as I discovered after doing some digging, there is in fact more, much more, to Zidane's story. When discussing and quoting Zidane, Harris cites a June 8, 2002 New York Times article. A close reading of the article reveals another side to the would-be suicide bomber. In the interest of time, I'll just highlight a few points. To quote the article, after Israel first raided Jenin's refugee camp at the beginning of March, Mr. Zidane said he began to think seriously about becoming a suicide bomber. So already we see there's something else going on here. With regard to his planned attack, he insisted that he had sought to kill only soldiers whom he described as overwhelming adversaries.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fairies. The author of the article, James Bennett, informs us that his 2+ hour conversation with Zidane, then 18 years old, took place in an Israeli hospital shortly after the failed attack, while Zidane was expected to be prosecuted. Guarded by 2 Israeli police officers and manacled by a wrist and an ankle to his bed, he said bitterly that he knew he would be jailed for life and remembered only as a terrorist. "I feel sorry because it was a mistake," he said. "But as a human being, I should live like others. The way there is an Israeli state, there are people living in this state, enjoying life, having someone protect them. I don't live in this situation. I don't feel I'm secure." Soldiers could enter Jenin at any time, he said, and he constantly feared being arrested. "As long as life continues like this," he said, "you will have people who think like me." He insisted that he wanted peace, but said he saw little chance for it. Now, assuming Zidane genuinely sought martyrdom at some point, it is difficult to overlook the obvious political dimensions of his actions, his challenging life experiences, and the circumstances of his conversation with Bennett, the author of the article, with Israeli officers nearby and a trial looming. But remember, all Harris tells us about Zidane's motivation to attack Israelis is that he was driven by a love of martyrdom. Furthermore, Harris never conveys Zidane's criticisms of the Israeli army. Instead, Harris simply tells us that Zidane conceded that his Jewish captors were better than many, many Arabs. This is a remarkable example of cherry picking. And we see something similar in Harris's treatment of Islamic scripture, as he cites various translated Quranic passages without giving due consideration to their respective contexts, the surrounding passages, and other more precise translations. And I provide examples in my book. But just to give you a sense of how skewed Harris's view of the Quran is, in an article published in 2014, Harris states that a hatred of infidels is arguably the central theme of the Quran. Remarkably, Harris neglects a much more pronounced theme, the consequential worship of and obedience to the one God. Furthermore, it is difficult to see hatred of infidels in Quranic passages such as Surah 5, Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse 5, which permits some forms of interreligious marriage, and Surah 60, Al-Mumtahina, verses 7 to 8, which read in translation, "God may still bring about affection between you and your present enemies. God is all-powerful. God is most forgiving and merciful. And he does not forbid you to deal kindly and equitably with anyone who has not fought you for your faith or driven you out of your homes. God loves those who act equitably." According to various Quranic commentators, the latter half of this passage was revealed after the Muslim companion, Asma, daughter of Abu Bakr, had refused to meet her visiting mother, a Meccan polytheist. Following this revelation, Asma received her mother in her home. And by the way, the majority view is that this passage was not abrogated. It remains valid for all times. And this is just one example. So when talking about jihad, Harris's sources are limited, as he relies heavily on the late Bernard Lewis. And I'll say more about Professor Lewis in just a moment. Muslim scholarly sources are noticeably absent from Harris's bibliography. And this might explain the following passage from The End of Faith. Harris writes, "Surely there are Muslim jurists who might say that suicide bombing is contrary to the tenets of Islam. Where are these jurists, by the way? And that suicide bombers are therefore not martyrs, but fresh denizens of hell. Such a minority opinion, if it exists, cannot love, change.
If it exists, that's right. If it exists,
cannot change the fact that suicide bombings have been rationalized by much of the Muslim world. Of course, the reality is that when Harris was writing this, multitudes, not all, of course, but multitudes of prominent clerics and scholars had publicly and explicitly condemned suicide missions and terrorism more broadly. These clerics and scholars range from members of the Fiqh Council of North America to the Saudi religious establishment, to the chief Sunni cleric of Bangladesh, to former Iranian president and Shi'i cleric Muhammad Khatami. And the list certainly goes on. Yet the fact that Harris makes this statement in such a popular book means that many people were misled.
Can I just focus on who T.J. Winter is? For those who don't know, he is a professor of Islamic studies at the University of Cambridge. He's one of the world's leading Islamic scholars. He is a Muslim himself. His Muslim name is Abdul Hakim Murad, as you can see there. So he's seen as a very reliable authority who certainly knows the Islamic tradition inside out. He knows Arabic and everything else as well. And also this word jihad, which unfortunately is still translated in the West as holy war. And there is no such thing, perhaps you can clarify, no such thing as holy war in Islam. There actually is holy war in the Bible, funnily enough. It's there in parts of the Old Testament where God commands God commands the genocide of whole peoples. And that is called holy war in the Bible. But in Islam, the concept doesn't exist. Jihad is a much broader category, isn't it? It is a struggle for all sorts of things, struggle for excellence. If I were to give up smoking, that could be my personal jihad. As well as the military aspect as well. But it's a much broader term, is it not?
Absolutely, it is a broad term. And I like to tell a story about when I was in high school. I tell my students this. When I was in high school, my junior year of high school, second to last year of high school, I was slacking. And one night I decided to study really hard. And my father, who's from Egypt, he sees me and he says, "Muhammad, that's a great jihad." And I tell my students, I can assure you he's not saying that's a great holy war. Even though doing homework might feel like that sometimes. No. Absolutely. I mean, jihad is a struggle for what is perceived to be a noble cause. It certainly includes the possibility of armed struggle. In fact, in the legal context, that's how the term is typically used. But outside of the legal domain, I mean, if you look at books on spirituality, we see this term often used to refer to the struggle to be a better person, for example, and so on and so forth. So absolutely.
That's why I just want to say that this translation of jihad as holy war is completely wrong and misleading, and is actually a borrowed Christian concept anyway. It's not an Islamic one.
Yeah, the terminology is certainly foreign. I mean, that specific terminology. Now, interestingly, at one point in The End of Faith, Harris remarks that one can only marvel that suicide bombing is not more widespread. And so with his focus firmly on Muslim extremists, Harris neglects the broader Islamic landscape. He was apparently unaware, for instance, that suicide attacks of any kind were historically uncommon in the Sunni tradition claimed by Sunni extremists. And by the way, we could say something similar about various other groups, such as Twelver Shiites. In the words of British Sunni scholar, Professor T.J. Winter, Abdul Hakim Murad, whom you just mentioned, he writes, "Targeting civilians is a negation of every possible school of Sunni Islam. Suicide bombing is so foreign to the Quranic ethos that the prophet Samson, who in the Bible and Judges engages in what could be called a suicide attack, is entirely absent from our scriptures." Interestingly, the very author that Harris relies on when discussing jihad, Professor Bernard Lewis, who was hardly an apologist for Islam, had this to say.
Readers may not know that Bernard Lewis, a professor at Princeton, was famously not in any way well disposed towards Islam as a political scientist and historian. So having him say what you're about to read is not coming from any sympathy from Islam. Yes.
You know, one of the things about, I have one of my advisors used to say at the University of Michigan that with Professor Lewis, you'd read four sentences and you think, oh, good point. And then that fifth sentence, you know, anyway, so, but obviously a big scholar, a big historian, and this is what he has to say in a later 2009 co-authored work. The emergence of the by now widespread terrorism practice of suicide bombing is a development of the 20th century. It has no antecedents in Islamic history and no justification in terms of Islamic theology, law, or tradition. It is a pity that those who practice this form of terrorism are not better acquainted with their own religion and with the culture that grew up under the auspices of that religion. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Harris opens The End of Faith by depicting a suicide bomber and asking the reader why it is so easy to guess his religion. But Harris never grapples with the fact that although this tactic of suicide bombing has been around for a while, the widespread conception of Muslim suicide bombing only begins to appear in the early 1980s. And even after then, the tactic of suicide bombing was never once employed in a conflict as intense as the Soviet-Afghan War, which incidentally involved so-called Mujahideen and foreign fighters like bin Laden.
Yes, because bin Laden was paid by the Americans, of course, to fight the Russians, the Soviets, at that point, as an ally. I mean, it's a part of the historical record. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's just well known.
Yeah. Well, certainly the U.S. was supporting the effort of the Mujahideen. And so be that as it may, as Harris would have it, Muslims have not found anything of substance to say against the actions of the September 11 hijackers. This, of course, is an unfortunate myth. The reality is that the targeting of innocent civilians was a recurring theme in the September 2001 condemnations issued by scholars, clerics, and the leadership of, among many other institutions, the 57-nation organization of the Islamic Conference, Al-Azhar in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Jama'ati Islami in both Pakistan and Bangladesh, the Nahda Renaissance movement in Tunisia, the Pan-Malaysian Islamic Party, and even Hamas. Not exactly pro-American, right?
Hamas, it's worth dwelling on that, but Hamas itself, which of course is often characterized as a terrorist group in the West, although not seen as a terrorist group elsewhere, condemned the 9/11 attacks as well.
Yeah, and I like to highlight this condemnation. I'd like to show this to my students because, you know, this is not a group that's sympathetic to the United States, right? And so here they are condemning the 9/11 attacks. And in fact, if Harris had simply picked up an issue, this is what we used to do back in those days, we'd pick up issues of newspapers. If he had simply picked up an issue of the San Jose Mercury News 5 days after the attacks, he would have seen an interview with a fellow Californian named Hamza Yusuf, an extremely influential Muslim scholar who explained why suicide terrorism and the 9/11 attacks could not be justified using Islamic sources. But not only does Harris seem aloof to the major currents of Islamic thought, he also fails to maintain a consistent line of reasoning. Twice in The End of Faith, Harris contrasts Islam with the pacifist Jain religion. First, he states that there's a reason we must now confront Muslim rather than Jain terrorists in every corner of the world. For Harris, the reason is simply the nature of the Islamic tradition. Now, to place his statement in perspective, the entire Jain population amounts to no more than 0.5% of the worldwide Muslim population and is mostly concentrated in India. Second, Harris asserts that in contrast with Islamic fundamentalism, a rise in Jain fundamentalism, and this is an important part, would endanger no one. Because observant Jains generally will not kill anything, including insects. And yet, just a few pages earlier, and in the context of defending the use of military technology, Harris describes pacifism as a deeply immoral position that comes to us swaddled in the dogma of highest moralism.
Oh dear. That's a bit of an inconsistency there, isn't it?
Oh yes, and not only that, he even goes on. He says that pacifism allows a variety of monsters currently loose in the world to threaten the rest of us.
That's a stunning observation. So just a quick question. I'm sure virtually everyone who's watching this know, but perhaps some don't. What does Islam permit suicide anyway as a general principle? And the Quran actually addresses this point. In chapter 4, verse 30 of the Quran, God says, "And kill not yourselves. Surely Allah is merciful to you." A suicide as such is prohibited by the Quran. Never mind military, so-called military suicide or terrorist suicide. It's prohibited full stop. So there's simply no space. I mean, we don't need scholars to condemn so-called suicide bombings when the Quran itself condemns suicide. It's there in hardwired into the sacred canon of Islam itself, without any doubt.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. But however, I should say that there are, you know, of course, there are people who will interpret things a variety of ways. And some people will say, well, this is not referring to suicide. It's referring like, you know, we don't kill members of our own community. People will argue that, well, these operations, they're not really suicide operations. So people will try to find ways around it. Obviously, the prevailing belief, though, I mean, it's widely understood that suicide is prohibited. I mean, you have explicit hadiths. You have, I mean, there's the evidence is overwhelmingly on the side of suicide being not just prohibited, but something that could actually lead to a terrifying punishment in the afterlife, even.
Exactly.
Yeah, and of course, that we have to be careful here too, because you know there's even a hadith about a person who committed suicide, and the Prophet, peace be upon him, talks about seeing this person in heaven but missing his hands. Something. I don't quote me on this, but something different about this person because he had committed suicide. But maybe he had some kind of. Some people have argued maybe there was some kind of a mental health issue there. In any case, this is something that you know scholars that are more knowledgeable than me can discuss. But in any case, in general, though, suicide is considered prohibited, and so that becomes a barrier, or that becomes a hurdle that if somebody tries to justify a suicide mission, they have to try to find a way to argue that that's not suicide.
Right.
And that's, of course, a challenge.
Okay.
Now, so going back to Harris, he's talking about how pacifism allows a variety of monsters currently loose in the world to threaten the rest of us. Then shortly after defending the limited use of torture when dealing with terrorists, he elaborates on the false choice. These are his words now. The false choice of pacifism, and explains why we must accept the fact that violence or its threat is often an ethical necessity. So Harris's conception of legitimate violence actually overlaps to a large extent with that of certain Muslims, and it actually seems to exceed the views of many other Muslims.
Yes, because by the way, if people don't know, obviously you know, sir, but torture as well is prohibited in Islam as well.
That's right.
Not suicide, but torture too. So he's advocating stuff now which is Islam would not tolerate, but more extreme behavior. Sam Harris is.
Certainly the prevailing belief in Islamic law is that that torture is prohibited. Yes.
Yeah.
But let's get back to Harris's main argument. As he sees it, what makes Muslims extreme is their devotion to the literal word of the Quran and the Hadith. Violent radicals, we are led to believe, are monsters precisely because of their close adherence to the letter of Scripture. This is a point Harris makes in various writings, including The End of Faith and his 2015 co-authored book, Islam and the Future of Tolerance.
Yes.
Ayan Hirsi Ali and Richard Dawkins make similar claims in their respective works. In her 2015 book, Heretic, Ali remarks that those who maintain that Muslim terrorism is actually a problem of poverty, insufficient education, or any other social precondition are offering, as she puts it, facile explanations. That is because, in her words, Islamic violence is rooted in the foundational texts of Islam itself. Dawkins makes similar claims in his 2006 New York Times bestseller, The God Delusion. Again, not having read the entire Quran. But in blaming Islam's foundational texts for contemporary terrorism, while downplaying other factors, Harris, Ali, and Dawkins present explanations that are just as facile as those of the apologists they criticize. To illustrate this point, let us consider the case of bin Laden. As we saw earlier, in the exchange between Fareed Zakaria and Sam Harris, the latter pointed to bin Laden as a model Muslim whose interpretation is honest, his interpretation of Islam is honest and straightforward. Now, in the interest of time, let's just examine one set of statements by bin Laden. In October 2001, bin Laden was interviewed by the well-known Al Jazeera reporter Taysir Al-Luni, an interview that was not aired until January 2002. In this conversation, which is said to be the most revealing exchange with bin Laden on record, bin Laden responded to the claim that the 9/11 hijackers had killed innocent civilians. He remarked, "It is very strange for Americans and other educated people to talk about the killing, for American and other educated people to talk about the killing of innocent civilians. I mean, who said that our children and civilians are not innocents and that the shedding of their blood is permissible? Whenever we kill their civilians," he says, "the whole world yells at us from east to west. And America starts putting pressure on its allies and puppets. Who said that our blood isn't blood and that their blood is blood? What about the people that have been killed in our lands for decades?" He would go on to declare that his people kill the civilians among the disbelievers in response to their killing of Muslims. Here, the interviewer, Al-Luni, interjected, "So you say that this is an eye for an eye. They kill our innocents, so we kill theirs." Bin Laden replied, "Yes, so we kill their innocents." This is valid both religiously and logically. But some of the people who talk about this issue discuss it from a religious point of view. So here, he's talking about the people who condemn these actions, the killing of civilians. Al-Luni asks, "What is their proof?" Bin Laden responds, "They say that the killing of innocents is wrong and invalid. And for proof, they say that the Prophet forbade the killing of children and women. And that is true. It is valid and has been laid down by the Prophet in an authentic tradition." Al-Luni interjected, "This is precisely what I'm talking about. This is exactly what I'm asking you about." Bin Laden continues, "But this forbidding of killing children and innocents is not set in stone."
Wow.
"And there are other writings that uphold it."
Wow. That is worth dwelling on.
Yes.
That phrase is,
yes,
not set in stone. When I first came across that statement, it's actually, you're quoting from this book, The Messages for the,
yes,
World, Statements of Osama bin Laden, by edited and collected by Bruce Lawrence, an American academic. And you can read the full interview in here. It's worth getting that book if you're interested in the arguments that bin Laden proposed. To say it's not set in stone, extraordinary. It sounds very modernist. It's saying, it's like some other people might say, well, the crime may prohibit X, but, well, you know, we're not going to go along with that today because it's not set in stone. It's not fundamentalist at all. It's not some fanatical adherence to the so-called literal meaning of a text. On the contrary, these things are not set in stone, he argues.
Exactly. I mean, when I saw this, I mean, this is why I underlined it, because it really stood out to me. Because, you know, to assume that he's a literalist, I mean, what he's doing here, he's engaging in interpretive acrobatics to justify his claim. And so, yeah, this really stood out to me as well. And what's interesting is what's going to happen, what he's going to say now in the rest of the interview.
Yep.
He goes on to quote the Quran. He quotes Surah 16, Surah An-Nahl, verse 126. This the beginning part of it. "If you believers respond to an attack, make your response proportionate." Okay. This verse actually appears in a passage that, according to most of the well-known commentaries on the Quran, actually encourages restraint. And one of the famous episodes that people like to point to here is when the Prophet, peace be upon him, sees the outcome of the Battle of Uhud, and he sees his uncle Hamza has been killed. He makes a strong statement about, you know, getting vengeance on the Meccans. And this verse is revealed, and the idea is that no, you can't go and kill, let's say, 70 or however many of their men, because they killed the response has to be proportionate. And actually, of course, later he would see the person who killed his uncle Hamza, and he, you know, he can't bear to look at him, but he forgives him. Yeah. So this actually is widely considered a passage that is encouraging restraint, which is interesting because Bin Laden is citing it in a different way here. In any case, Bin Laden continued, and this is, I think, the most interesting part of the whole interview. He says, the scholars and people of knowledge, among them Sahib al-Ikhtiyarat, this is a reference to Ibn Taymiyyah, and Ibn al-Qayyim, the student of Ibn Taymiyyah. And just to give people background, Ibn Taymiyyah is a 14th century scholar, 14th century of the Common Era scholar. Ibn al-Qayyim is his student, okay? And al-Shawkani of the modern period, and many others, and al-Qurtubi, another pre-modern commentator of the Quran, a famous commentator of the Quran. May God bless him. So notice he's taking a moment to praise Al-Qurtubi. In his Quran commentary, all these people, they say that if the disbelievers were to kill our children and women, then we should not feel ashamed to do the same to them, mainly to deter them from trying to kill our children and women again. So he presents this as a view of these four big giants of Islamic thought.
And this, if it's true, is actually a powerful argument Islamically, because the ulama, as they're called, the scholarly class, carry a lot of weight. They're the successors of the Prophet himself in some ways. So this is not a trivial point, actually, if what he's saying is true, however. And that's the rub in this story.
Exactly. And, you know, what's interesting is I noticed a lot of secondary sources, or at least a few secondary sources, assuming that Bin Laden is correct on this, assuming that these four scholars actually say what he claims they're saying. Now, let's take a moment and analyze and look at these four names carefully. Let's analyze these people carefully. So we have Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn al-Qayyim, al-Shawkani, and al-Qurtubi. And remember, with al-Qurtubi, Bin Laden took a moment to praise, to say, may God bless him. Okay. Now, what's interesting is, if you analyze their writings, you will not find what Bin Laden is claiming, they say. In fact, the Quran commentator Bin Laden invoked and praised, al-Qurtubi explicitly rejected it, what Bin Laden claimed. He explicitly rejected it in his exegetical writings. And I have to tell you, Paul, when I saw this, I was shocked. You don't find something this clear-cut, usually.
Yeah.
So here is al-Qurtubi saying, even if enemy forces killed, this is it, by the way, in his commentary on Surah 5, so anyone can see it. Surah 5, Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse 8. You can go and see the commentary yourselves. Even if enemy forces killed our women and children and made us grieve on account of this, then it is still not permissible for us to kill them intentionally in a similar manner to cause them to grieve and be sad. And the available writings of the other scholars invoked by Bin Laden reveal no obvious departure from al-Qurtubi on this matter.
So just to sum up, I think Bin Laden's claim here of backing from very distinguished ulama, Islamic scholars, is completely bogus. You've actually quoted the very person he praises, invokes God's blessing on him, who says precisely the opposite of what Bin Laden claims that he said. But this is remarkable. And thank you for you to do due diligence here and to check these things out. Because as you say, sometimes we just take these words for granted. But it's really important always to check our sources with the originals. And often we get surprised.
Absolutely. Now, viewers might wonder, so what did these four scholars say that might have led Bin Laden to say this, or at least maybe he heard something about them that led him to say this? Well, these scholars do say things like, okay, you're not supposed to, you know, use certain weapons, but if the enemy uses them, you can use those weapons. If they use fire, let's say, then you can use fire. You get these kinds of discussions, but nothing about targeting innocent civilians. And that's the key point, is that even if the enemy is targeting your innocent civilians, you cannot target their innocent civilians.
Right.
And that was the key point. Now, are there methods that could be destructive, that could lead to collateral casualties? Yes, that's where you get some discussions that are a bit more interesting, a bit more complex. And even here, and I do address this in the book as well. Even here, again, we have to be careful because this whole collateral casualty business, you know, there's a difference between targeting soldiers and targeting something other than soldiers. Or a group other than soldiers. One cannot claim collateral casualties and then, you know, just target whatever. Just to kind of give it one interesting example of this, people like to mention that the Prophet, peace be upon him, used catapults the battle against Banu Thaqif, one of the tribes in Ta'if. And what's interesting is when you begin to go through all the reports that we have, you find that it's actually not that simple. First of all, probably the most detailed account we have comes from Al-Waqidi. Al-Waqidi gives really the only sort of detailed account we have. And in that account, we see that the Muslims are unable to breach a wall that's fortified. And Salman the Persian, the companion of the Prophet, says, well, we use al-manjaniq or mangonels, a kind of simple catapult, basically, that you know we would throw stones at the wall to breach the wall. So notice the suggestion is to breach a wall, not to throw the stone over the wall and hurt whoever happens to be there. Mm. And the Muslims don't even use it, according to al-Waqidi. They try to prepare it, and then 12 Muslims are killed just trying to prepare it, so they give up on that idea altogether. So that's the only detailed account we have. And yet people will often cite this to say, oh, look, as if the catapults are being thrown over the wall and killing whoever happened to be there. So anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, so there's a lot more that one could say now about bin Laden's various ostensibly contradictory justifications for the 9/11 attacks. Suffice it to say, he was by no means a true literalist. No. Of course. One could say that Muslims are generally not true literalists. And yet, it is critical to recognize that the attempts of extremists to justify the killing of innocent civilians on Islamic grounds typically require the abandonment of both strict literalism and the historically prevailing interpretations of Islamic thought.
Yeah.
And the interpretations of such radicals are hardly, as Harris puts it, straightforward. They are their own thing.
I mean, the thing, important to stress, I think, is for me, is that there is such a thing as normative Islam.
Yes.
A normative understanding of Islam. It's not a free-for-all.
That's right. Where
anyone, bin Laden or any individual, come along and say, well, I think it means this. No, there is a normative tradition exemplified by the four schools, for example, and the ulama.
You've
referred to several of them there. And this is normative Islam. So there are inappropriate, deviant forms of Islam, if one can call them that at all. And then there's normative Islam, which is the correct path, the path that we're supposed to follow. So bin Laden is clearly not in the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But we can't see it. We can't leave it at that. We must ask, what exactly has motivated Muslim extremists who have killed many civilians and themselves? You know, what's the motivation? What's going on here? You know, we've seen various prominent new atheists explain such phenomena by pointing to Islam, not idiosyncratic interpretations of the religion, but the core of the religion itself, and downplaying other factors. In contrast, you have people like terrorism specialists, like Jessica Stern, who find that terrorists are typically motivated by multiple factors and that terrorist movements often arise in reaction to an injustice, real or imagined, that they feel must be corrected. So, and here I should point out, you know, many people would agree with many of the grievances of bin Laden, right? They may agree with many of his grievances. They just wouldn't agree with, like, what's the next step? You know, how do you respond to that?
It's interesting. As someone, I remember the British Prime Minister Tony Blair was very clear and adamant on the record that talking about so-called Islamic terrorism, and that's an oxymoron in my view. Islam is not nothing to do with terrorism. But anyway, I use that jargon. He says that it has no motivation at all from anyone feeling a sense of injustice or that there's no political or systemic factors at all. And he completely rejected that. And I thought that was a remarkable thing to say, given what bin Laden himself had said in messages to the world, statements,
that's right,
for example, where he explicitly references the Palestinians, the killing of people, civilians in Iraq, and so on. What he perceives as foreign policy atrocities committed by certain powers as his alleged reason for doing it. But Tony Blair dismisses all this. No, there are no injustices. There are no injustices at all in the world. It's purely to do with ideology. And that's a serious politician, apparently. But as you say, Jessica Stern gives a very different view.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You showed this book edited by Bruce Lawrence, Messages of the World. That's a collection of statements by bin Laden and interviews and whatnot.
Yeah.
I would encourage folks to check it out, because what's interesting is that you see again and again a list of grievances.
Yeah.
Some that would be widely shared by other Muslims, some not. But the point is, you see a list of usually political grievances. Mm. And I'll say more about that in just a second.
Okay.
But I'd like to close by returning to Sam Harris, actually.
Mm.
As I mentioned earlier, in October 2014, Harris appeared on Real Time with Bill Maher. In the midst of a heated exchange with actor Ben Affleck on the subject of Islam, Harris, having stated that he was actually well-educated on the topic, proclaimed, "We have to be able to criticize bad ideas, and Islam is the motherlode of bad ideas." He proceeded to claim that suicide bombers occupy the center of Muslim communities. He added, "We're misled to think that the fundamentalists are the fringe." To which host Bill Maher chimed in, "That's the key point."
Yeah.
The Islam that Harris portrays in his writings does indeed appear to be a mother load of bad ideas, but it is an understanding of Islam that the vast majority of Muslims, whether scholars or lay people, would not recognize, a mother load of bad analysis. Mm. It is even more extreme in some ways than bin Laden's version of Islam. This is because Harris draws a nearly straight line from the Islamic tradition to 9/11. He erroneously downplays the significance of non-religious factors when assessing the Al-Qaeda leader, asserting that bin Laden's grievances were purely theological.
Yeah.
Bin Laden's Islam, however, was not that simple. His views on jihad were formed through convoluted reasoning and guided by a particular perception of geopolitical reality. Much of his reasoning was based on a notion of retribution, of responding to the U.S. And this is why in 2004, he would say that there's a reason he's not calling for war against Sweden. As such, Zakaria missed the mark when he told Harris, "The problem is you and Osama bin Laden agree. After all, you're saying his interpretation of Islam is correct. In point of fact, Harris's interpretation of Islam is so aberrant, so extreme, that it cannot even be ascribed to the man behind 9/11. And on that somber note, I will stop the presentation.
Okay. Now, that's extremely interesting. Thank you very much indeed for that. The interesting point there, when bin Laden was claiming that there's a reason why they haven't attacked Sweden, because yes, Sweden was not invading countries. Was America and Britain were, of course.
Yeah. And by the way, he has another statement where he says that had we not been Muslim, we would still be calling for this war, which I think is an interesting statement.
I haven't heard of that statement. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, coming from within Islam itself, as you and I are Muslims, we're very aware of the Ummah, the body of Muslims globally, are acutely sensitive to injustices and crimes and persecutions against Muslims around the world, whether they be in, you know, the Middle East or in China and so on. So it's entirely credible that someone who, through a warped sense of revenge, might seek to take vengeance on the alleged perpetrators. So to ignore that factor, I mean, to discount it like Tony Blair did or Sam Harris did and attribute it to so-called theological reasons, whatever that means, is to do a great injustice to the perceived sense of solidarity and awareness of how other brothers and sisters in the family of Islam are suffering as a result of injustice. And that's a terrible slight against human feeling and human suffering, yes. I think. And it comes from a certain, dare I say, Anglo-American insensitivity to what the how the other, the otherization of Muslims, how they experience the results of our actions in the world, our meaning the West's actions around the world. We don't really care what these Muslims or these brown people, whatever, you know, a subliminal racism, perhaps, how they suffer, because we're right, because we're Americans, we're British. I don't mean to kind of be horrible here, but I think there is an element of kind of the effortless superiority of the West and that we know best. And if other people suffer, well, that's tough, but there we go. You know, it's a horrible, horrible, if you're on the other side of that ideology, the receiving end of it, things look very different, very, very different if you see things from the other side. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think that's why it's people like yourself, the work you do is important. To, you know, you're in the UK, you're a voice in the UK. It's important for people to hear your voice. And I'm in the United States, you know, so it's important for people to, you know, that we be heard.
Yeah, yeah, and this is an ongoing. It's an ongoing mission to educate. Really, it's jihad of education, to use the term in its correct way. It's a struggle to educate people, and in that regard, your book, which is available in paperback, "Jihad, Radicalism, and the New Atheism," is excellent. Actually, as I say, it's very readable. It was quite triggering reading it because these issues are very raw, they're very existential, they're political. But it's a scholarly work. There's lots of it's annotated with the critical apparatus. It's well referenced. It's not a work of propaganda or polemics. It's a careful scholarly academic survey of all these things you've just been talking about in much more detail. So if you want to read more about what we've been talking about or what Professor Cullen is talking about, that's a good place to start, I think. I have one question for you. I've been dying to ask all the way through the interview, and I really don't know the answer to this question. It really is bugging me. You have effectively, in my view, refuted Sam Harris and the New Atheists in their complete straw manning of Islam and the sources and the Quran and the Sunnah and so on. Why don't they change their minds? Why don't they reform? You see, Sam Harris, I think, has a scientific background, does he not? I mean, yes. He had a PhD in neuroscience or something. So he understands, and Richard Dawkins, obviously, is a scientist at Oxford, retired. My point is, so they understand the scientific methodology. When new evidence comes along, empirical facts come along, you change your understanding of the world to accord with the facts. So why haven't these guys apparently changed their worldview in the light of the facts that you have so eloquently presented, and others too? Why are they still holding on to these completely mistaken notions about Islam and Muslims? This is why I don't understand.
Yeah, good question. I will say there have been some changes. There have been some changes. I'm not going to say that, you know, any major changes, but there have been changes. I mean, just to give a simple example, Sam Harris, you know, 2015, he co-authors a book with a figure named Mejid Nawaz. And I understand there's some discussion about his approach. But in any case, he was willing to have a dialogue with a Muslim and to entertain some ideas that maybe he wouldn't have entertained in the past. Okay, that's one change. Another change, at one point a few years ago, said he regretted the title, The Problem with Islam. So this is chapter 4 of The End of Faith. So he did indicate that he did regret the title of the chapter. Now, when you kind of get into it, though, his views are still pretty very, I mean, the key points are still there. The major ideas, the reason he doesn't like the title, I forgot the reason, but it was not something that would indicate that there was any substantive change to his thinking regarding violence in Islam.
No, I go on Amazon, which I'm looking at the moment, The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason, Sam Harris. It's still on
sale. It's still there. Yeah, it's still there.
The misinformation and the, frankly, incorrect and even lies, one might say, are still being popularized and pumped around the world. So he's not seen fit to withdraw this publication in the light of the facts. He's still promoting these distorted understandings.
Yes, and I think his regret was really just the wording. I don't think... recent articles, he will still refer to the Quran as a dangerous text, a text that calls for, you know, hatred of infidels and that kind of thing. At least from what I've seen, you know, I have to say, since publishing this book, I haven't really been following Harris as closely as I used to. I guess what I take, what I'm happy to see is that more and more people are willing to listen and to learn. And I see that in my students. It's interesting. When I started teaching in 2006, I was a grad student, but I was teaching as an instructor. And the first day of class, I would ask students, tell me the first thing that pops into your mind when I say Islam or Islam or Muslim or Moslem or Muslim. And in those early, in that period, we would get a lot of really disturbing responses, you know. And then, of course, you get a couple of things sprinkled in, like Ramadan or mosque. Okay.
That would be the odd Muslim in your audience, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Fast forward to, I don't remember when let's say 8 years ago, 7 years ago, when I would ask the same question, I at that point, negative response. Now, could it be that people were now shy suddenly? I don't know. But the answers are, in recent years, have been overwhelmingly either neutral or positive. The last couple of times I've done it, it's like mosque and, you know, Ramadan and Hajj and, you know, that kind of thing. So that's a big shift. That's a big change. I see that as a positive sign.
Yeah. There's another book I recommend as well. This book called War and Peace in Islam, The Uses and Abuses of Jihad. Now, you can actually get this as a PDF online for free, although you can buy it. It's quite a whopping big, thick book. Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, Tim Winter from Cambridge, says a dynamic myth-busting clarification of the real position of mainstream Orthodox Islam. This is the normative tradition I was referring to on the whole question of violence and jihad. So this published by the Islamic Tech Society, Cambridge. So you can get it for free online, quite legitimately, by the way. I do recommend that. And it's a bunch of essays by experts who specialize in this subject, obviously in English. So I recommend that book as well as Professor Khalil's work as well. Good. Oh, well, but it's a fantastic, presentation, disturbing and enlightening in equal measure. Great to hear that your new students are no longer coming up with these appalling tropes. Not great that Sam Harris is just concerned with tweaking with some of the cosmetics of his book, not seemingly withdrawing it from publication. Anyway, our jihad for education, or your jihad for education, your struggle for the truth about Islam continues. And I wish you Godspeed with that, sir. And thank you very much, Professor Khalil.
Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Until next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.